Neither the languid river nor the wild wood materialized, though China strained to see them. Ratty, Mole, Mr. Badger, and Mr. Toad were gone forever into the hateful death that claims all things. And the sadness of this, in its way, was as great as the sadness of what had happened to Laura, and would soon happen to China herself. Vess said, "Once in a while I bring one of them back to the room in the cellar, and always for the same purpose." She didn't want to hear this. The handcuffs made it difficult to cover her ears, and if she had tried, he would have shackled her wrists to her ankles. He would insist that she listen. "The most intense experiences of my life have all taken place in that room, China. Not the sex, not the beating or the cutting. That all comes later, and it's a lagniappe. First, I break them down, and that is when it gets intense." Her chest was tight. She could breathe only shallowly. He said, "The first day or two, they all think they'll go out of their minds with fear, but they're wrong. It takes longer than a day or two to drive someone insane, truly and irrevocably insane. Ariel is my seventh captive, and the others all held onto their sanity for weeks. One of them cracked on the 18th day, but three of them lasted a full 2 months." China gave up on the elusive wild wood and met his gaze across the table. "Psychological torture is so much more interesting and difficult to undertake than the physical variety, although the latter can be undeniably thrilling," Vess said. "The mind is so much tougher than the body, a greater challenge by far, and when the mind goes, I swear that I can hear the crack, a harder sound than bone splitting, and oh, how it reverberates." She tried to see the animal consciousness in his eyes, which she had glimpsed unexpectedly before. She needed to see it. "When they crack, some of them writhe on the floor, thrash, rend their clothes. They tear at their hair, China, and claw their faces, and some of them bite themselves hard enough to draw blood. They maim themselves in so many inventive ways. They sob and sob, can't stop for hours, sometimes for days, sobbing in their sleep. They bark like dogs, China, and screech and flail their arms as if they're convinced that they can fly. They hallucinate and see things more frightening than I am to them. Some speak in tongues. It's called glossolalia. Do you know the condition? Quite fascinating. Convincingly like a language, yet meaningless, a ranting or pleading babble. Some lose control of their bodily functions and wallow in their filth, messy but riveting to watch, the true base condition of humanity, to which most people can only admit in madness." As hard as she tried, China could see no beast in his eyes, only a placid blueness in the watchful darkness of the pupil, and she was no longer sure that she had ever seen it. He wasn't half man and half wolf, not a creature that fell to all fours in the light of the full moon. Worse, he was nothing but a man, living at one extreme end of the spectrum of human cruelty, but nonetheless, only a man. "Some take refuge in catatonic silences," Vess continued, "as Ariel has done, but I always break them out of that. Ariel is by far the most stubborn, but that only makes her interesting. I'll break her too, and when her crack comes, China, it'll be like no other. Glorious. Intense."
"The most intense experience of all is showing mercy," China said,
and had no idea whatsoever where she had found those words. They sounded like a plea, and she didn't want him to think that she was begging for her life. Even in her despair, she would not be reduced to groveling. A sudden smile made Vess look almost like a boy, one given to puns and pranks, collector of baseball cards, rider of bikes, builder of model airplanes, an altar boy on Sundays. She thought that he was smiling at what she'd said, amused by her naivete, but this was not the case, as he made clear with his next words.
"Maybe. What I want from you," Vess said, "is to be with me when I finally make Ariel snap. Instead of killing you in front of her to drive her over the edge, I'll drive her some other way, and you can watch."
"Oh, God. You're a psychology student, after all, almost a genuine master of psychology, right? Sitting there in such stern judgment of me, so certain that my mind is aberrant and that you know exactly how I think. Well then, how interesting it would be to see if any of the modern theories of the working of the mind are undone by this little experiment. Don't you think so? After I break Ariel, you could write a paper about it, China, from my eyes only. I'd enjoy reading your considered observations." Dear God, it would never come to that. She'd never be a witness to such a thing, though in shackles she would find a way to commit suicide before she would let him take her down to that room to watch that lovely girl, to watch her dissolve. China would bite open her own wrists, swallow her tongue, contrive to fall down the steps and break her neck, something, something. Evidently aware that he had jolted her out of her gray despair into stark horror, Vess smiled again, and then turned his attention to her breakfast plate.
Do you intend to eat the rest of that?
No.
Then I'll have it.
He slid his empty plate aside and pulled hers in front of him. Using her fork, he cut a bite-sized piece of the cold omelet, put it in his mouth, and moaned softly in delight, slowly, sensuously. Vess extracted the tines from his mouth, pressing his lips firmly around them as they slid loose, then reaching with his tongue for one last lick. After he swallowed the bite of eggs, he said,
I could taste you on the fork. Your saliva has a lovely flavor, except for a faint bitterness. No doubt that's not a usual component, just the result of a sour stomach.
She could find no escape by closing her eyes, so she watched as he devoured the remains of her breakfast. When he finished, she had a question of her own. Last night, why did you eat the spider?
Why not?
That's no answer.
It's the best answer to any question.
Then give me second best.
You think it was disgusting?
I'm just curious.
No doubt you see it as a negative experience, eating an icky, squirmy spider.
No doubt.
But there are no negative experiences, China, only sensations. No values can be attached to pure sensation.
Of course they can.
If you think so, then you're in the wrong century. Anyway, the spider had an interesting flavor, and now I understand spiders better for having absorbed one. Do you know about flatworm learning?
Flatworm?
You should have encountered it in a basic biology course along the way to becoming such a highly educated woman. You see, certain flatworms can gradually learn to negotiate a maze.
She did remember, and interrupted. Then if you grind them up and feed them to another batch of flatworms, batch number 2 can run the same maze on the first try.
Good, yes.
Vess nodded happily. They absorb the knowledge with the flesh. She didn't need to consider how to phrase her next question, for Vess could be neither insulted nor flattered. Jesus, you don't actually believe you now know what it's like to be a spider, have all the knowledge of a spider because you've eaten one?
Of course not, China. If I were that literal-minded, I'd be crazy, wouldn't I? In an institution somewhere, talking to a crowd of imaginary friends. But because of my sharp senses, I did absorb from the spider an ineffable quality of spiderness that you will never be able to understand. I heightened my awareness of the spider as a marvelously engineered little hunter, a creature of power. Spider is a power word, you know, though it can't be formed from the letters of my name.
He hesitated, pondering, and then continued,
It can be formed from the letters of your name.
She didn't bother to remind him about her mother's precious spelling. Only Spider, S-P-Y-D-E-R, could be found in China Shepherd.
And it was risky eating a spider, which added considerably to the appeal.
Vess continued,
Unless you're an entomologist, you can't be sure if any particular specimen is poisonous or not. Some, like the brown recluse, are extremely dangerous. A bite on the hand is one thing, but I had to be sure that I was quick and crushed it against the roof of my mouth before it could bite my tongue.
You like taking risks?
He shrugged. I'm just that kind of guy.
On edge.
Words in my name,
he acknowledged. And if you've been bitten on the tongue?
Pain is the same as pleasure, just different. Learn to enjoy it, and you're happier with life.
Even pain is value neutral?
Sure. Just sensation. It helps grow the reef of the soul. If there is a soul.
She didn't know what the hell he was talking about, the reef of the soul, and she didn't ask. She was weary of him, weary of fearing him, even weary of hating him. With her questions, she was striving to understand, as she had striven all her life, and she was tired to death of this search for meaning. She would never know why some people committed countless little cruelties, or bigger ones, and the struggle to understand had only exhausted her and left her empty, cold, and gray inside. Pointing to her red and swollen index finger, Vess said, "That must hurt. And your neck." "The headache's the worst of it, and none of it's anything like pleasure." "Well, I can't easily show you the way to enlightenment and prove you're wrong. It takes time, but there's a smaller lesson, quick to learn." He got up from his chair and went to a spice rack at the end of the kitchen cabinets. Among the small bottles and tins of thyme, cloves, dill, nutmeg, chili pepper, ginger, marjoram, and cinnamon was a bottle of aspirin. "I don't take this for headaches because I like to savor the pain, but I keep aspirin on hand because once in a while I like to chew on them for the taste." "They're vile." "Just bitter. Bitterness can be as pleasing as sweetness when you learn that every experience, every sensation is worthwhile." He returned to the table with the bottle of aspirin. He put it in front of her and took away her glass of water. "No, thanks," she said. "Bitterness has its place." She ignored the bottle. "Suit yourself," Vess said, clearing the plates off the table. Although China needed relief from her various pains, she refused to touch the aspirin. Perhaps irrationally, but nonetheless strongly, she felt that by chewing a few of the tablets, even strictly for the medicinal effect, she would be stepping into the strange rooms of Edgler Vess's madness. This was a threshold that she didn't care to cross for any purpose, even with one foot solidly anchored in the real world. He hand-washed the breakfast plates, bowls, pans, and utensils. He was efficient and fastidious, using steaming hot water and lots of lemon-scented dishwashing liquid. China had one more question that could not go unasked, and at last she said, "Why the Templetons? Why choose them of all people? It wasn't random, was it? Not just the place you happened to stop in the night."
"Not just random,"
he agreed, scrubbing the omelet pan with a plastic scouring pad. "A few weeks back, Paul Templeton was up this way on business, and when..."
"You knew him?"
"Not really. He was in town, the county seat, on business, like I said. And as he was taking something from his wallet to show me, a set of those little hinged plastic windows fell out, you know, with little wallet-sized photographs, and I picked them up for him. One of the pictures was his wife, another was Laura. She looked so... fresh, unspoiled. I said something like, 'That's a pretty girl.' And Paul was off and running about her, every inch the proud papa. Told me she was soon going to have her master's degree in psychology, 3.8 grade average, and everything. He told me how he really missed her away at school, even after 6 years of getting used to it, and how he couldn't wait for the end of the month because Laura was coming home for a 3-day weekend. He didn't mention she was bringing along a friend.
An accident. Photos dropped. A casual exchange. Mere idle conversation. The arbitrariness of it was breathtaking, and almost more than China could bear. Then, as she watched Vess thoroughly wiping off the counters and rinsing the dishpan and scrubbing the sink, China began to feel that what had happened to the Templeton family was worse than merely arbitrary. All this violent death began to seem fated, an inexorable spiral into lasting darkness, as if they had been born and had lived only for Edgler Vess. It was as if she too had been born and had struggled this far only for the purpose of bringing one moment of sick satisfaction to this soulless predator. The worst horror of his rampages was not the pain and fear that he inflicted, not the blood, not the mutilated cadavers. The pain and the fear were comparatively brief, considering all the routine pain and anxiety of life. The blood and bodies were merely aftermath. The worst horror was that he stole meaning from the unfinished lives of those people he killed, made himself the primary purpose of their existence, robbed them not of time, but of fulfillment. His base sins were envy, of beauty, of happiness, and pride, bending the whole world to his view of creation. And these were the greatest sins of all, the same transgressions over which the devil himself, once an archangel, had stumbled and fallen a long way out of heaven. Hand-drying the plates, pans, and flatware in the drainage rack, returning each piece to the proper shelf or drawer, Edgler Vess looked as pink-clean as a freshly bathed baby and as innocent as the stillborn. He smelled of soap, a good bracing aftershave, and lemon-scented dishwashing liquid. But in spite of all of this, China found herself superstitiously expecting to detect a whiff of brimstone. Every life led to a series of quiet epiphanies, or at least to opportunities for epiphanies, and China was washed by a poignant new grief when she thought about this grim aspect of the Templeton family's interrupted journeys. The kindnesses they might have done for others, the love they might have given, the things they might have come to understand in their hearts. Vess finished the breakfast cleanup and returned to the table.
"I have a few things to do upstairs, outside. And then I'll have to sleep 4 or 5 hours if I can. I've got to go to work this evening. I need my rest."
She wondered what work he did, but she didn't ask. He might be talking about a job, or about his dogged assault on Ariel's sanity. If the latter, China didn't want to know what was coming.
"When you shift around in the chair, do it easy. Those chains will scrape the wood if you're not careful."
"I'd hate to mar the furniture," she said. He stared at her for perhaps half a minute and then said,
"If you're stupid enough to think you can get free, I'll hear the chains rattling, and I'll have to come back in here to quiet you. If that's necessary, you won't like what I'll do."
She said nothing. She was hopelessly hobbled and chained down. She couldn't possibly escape.
"Even if you somehow get free of the table and chairs, you can't move fast, and attack dogs patrol the grounds."
"I've seen them," she assured him.
"If you weren't chained, they'd still drag you down and kill you before you'd gone 10 steps from the door."
She believed him, but she didn't understand why he felt the need to press the point so hard.
"I once turned a young man loose in the yard," Vess said. "He raced straight to the nearest tree and got up and out of harm's way with only one bad bite in his right calf and a nip on the left ankle. He braced himself in the branches and thought he would be safe for a little while, with the dog circling below and watching him. But I got a .22 rifle and went out on the back porch and shot him in the leg from there. He fell out of the tree. And then it was all over in maybe a minute."
China said nothing. There were moments when communicating with this hateful thing seemed no more possible than discussing the merits of Mozart with a shark. This was one of those moments.
"You were invisible to me last night," he said.
She waited. His gaze traveled over her, and he seemed to be looking for a loose link in one of the chains or a handcuff left open and unnoticed until now.
"Like a spirit."
She was not sure that it was ever possible to discern what this thing was thinking, but right now, by God, it seemed to be vaguely uneasy about leaving her alone. She couldn't for the life of her imagine why.
"Stay," he said.
She nodded.
"Good girl."
He went to the door between the kitchen and the living room. Realizing that they had one more issue to discuss, she said,
"Before you go..."
He turned to look at her. "Could you take me to a bathroom?" she asked.
"It's too much trouble to undo the chains just now," he said. "Piss in your pants if you have to. I'm going to clean you up later anyway, and I can buy new chair cushions."
He pushed through the door into the living room and was gone. China was determined not to endure the humiliation of sitting in her own waste. She had a faint urge to pee, but it wasn't insistent yet. Later she would be in trouble. How odd that she could still care about avoiding humiliation or think about the future.
Halfway across the living room, Mr. Vess stops to listen to the woman in the kitchen. He hears no clink of chains. He waits, and still no sound. The silence troubles him. He's not sure what to make of her. He knows so much about her now, yet she still contains mysteries. Shackled and in his complete control, surely she cannot be his blown tire. She smells of despair and defeat. In the beaten tone of her voice, he sees the gray of ashes and feels the texture of a coffin blanket. She is as good as dead, and she is resigned to it, yet... From the kitchen comes the clink of chains. Not loud, not a vigorous assault on her bonds. Just a quiet rattle as she shifts position. Perhaps to clasp her thighs tightly together to repress the urge to urinate. Mr. Vess smiles. He goes upstairs to his room. From the top shelf at the back of his walk-in closet, he takes down a telephone. In the bedroom, he plugs it into a wall jack and makes 2 calls, letting people know that he has returned from his 3-day vacation and will be back in harness by this evening.
Although he is confident that the Dobermans in his absence will never allow anyone to get into the house, Vess keeps only 2 phones and secretes them in closets when he is not at home. In the extremely unlikely event that an intruder should manage to sprint through the attacking dogs and get into the house alive, he will not be able to call for help. The danger of cellular phones has been on Mr. Vess's mind in recent days. It's difficult to imagine a would-be burglar carrying a portable phone or using it to call the police for help from a house in which he's become trapped by guard dogs. But stranger things have happened. If China Shepherd had found a cellular phone in the clerk's Honda the previous night, she would not be the one now languishing in shackles. The technological revolution here at the end of the millennium offers numerous conveniences and great opportunities, but it also has dangerous aspects. Thanks to his expertise with computers, he has cleverly altered his fingerprint files with various agencies and can go without gloves at places like the Templeton House, enjoying the full sensuality of the experience without fear. But one cellular phone in the wrong hands at the wrong time could lead suddenly to the most intense experience of his life. And the final one. He sometimes longs for the simpler age of Jack the Ripper, or the splendid Ed Gein who inspired Psycho, or Richard Speck. He dreams wistfully of the less complicated world of earlier decades and of killing fields that were less trampled then by such as he. By feverishly pursuing high ratings, by hyping every story steeped in blood, by making celebrities out of killers, and by fawning over celebrity killers, the electronic news media happily may have inspired more of his clear-thinking kind. But they have also alarmed the sheep too much. Too many in the herd are wall-eyed with alertness and quick to run at the first perception of danger. Still, he manages to have his fun. After making his calls, Mr. Vess goes out to the motorhome. The license plates, the blunt end screws and the nuts to attach them to the vehicle, and a screwdriver are in a drawer in the kitchenette. By various means, usually 2 or 3 weeks prior to one of his expeditions, Mr. Vess carefully selects his primary targets, like the Templeton family. And though he sometimes brings back a living prize for the cellar room, he nearly always travels well beyond the borders of Oregon to minimize the chances that his 2 lives, good citizen and homicidal adventurer, will cross at the most inconvenient moment. Though he didn't employ this method to get Laura Templeton, he has found that clandestine browsing via computer through the huge Department of Motor Vehicle Records in neighboring California is an excellent method of locating attractive women. Their driver's license photographs, headshots only, are now on file with the DMV. Provided with each picture are the woman's age, height, and weight, statistics that assist Vess in identifying unacceptable candidates, so he can avoid grandmothers who photograph well and plump women with thin faces. And though some people list post office boxes only, most use their street addresses. Thereafter, Mr. Vess needs only a series of good maps. Upon nearing the end of his drive, when he gets within 50 miles of the target residence, he removes the license plates from the motor home. Later, because he makes a point of being far away from the scene of his games by the time that anyone finds the aftermath, he could be tracked down only if someone in the victim's neighborhood happened to see the motor home and, though it looked perfectly innocent, happened to glance at the plates and, that damn blown tire again, happened to have a photographic memory. Usually, he leaves the tags off his vehicle until he is safely back in Oregon. If he were stopped by a police officer for speeding or for some other traffic violation, he would express surprise when asked about his missing license plates and would say that, for God knows what reason, they must have been stolen. He is a good actor. He could sell his bafflement. If the chance arose to do so without putting himself in serious jeopardy, he would kill the cop. And if no such opportunity presented itself, he would most likely be able to count on a swift resolution of the problem by calling upon professional courtesy. Now he squats on his haunches and attaches one of the tags to the frame in the front license plate niche. One by one, the dogs come to him, sniffing at his hands and his clothes, perhaps disappointed to find only the sense of aftershave and dishwashing soap. They are starved for attention, but they are on duty. None of them lingers long, each returning to its patrol after one pat on the head, a scratch behind the ears, and a word of affection. "Good dog," Mr. Vess says to each. "Good dog." When he finishes with the front plate, he stands, stretches, and yawns while surveying his domain. At ground level, anyway, the wind has died. The air is still and moist. It smells of wet grass, earth, moldering dead leaves, and pine forests. With the rain finished, the mist is lifting off the foothills and off the lower flanks of the mountains behind the house. He can't see the peaks of the western range yet, or even the blanket of snow lingering on the higher slopes. But directly overhead and to the east, where the mist doesn't intervene, the clouds are more gray than thunderhead black, a soft moleskin gray, and they are moving rapidly southeast in front of a high-altitude wind. By midnight, as he had promised Ariel, there might be stars and even a moon to light the tall grass in the meadow and to shine in the milky eyes of the dead Laura. Mr. Vess goes to the back of the motorhome to attach the second license plate and discovers odd tracks on the driveway. As he stands staring at them, a frown pools and deepens on his face. The driveway is shale, but during a heavy rain, mud washes out from the surrounding yard. Here and there, it forms a thin skin atop the stone, not soupy, but dark and dense. In this skin of mud are hoof impressions, perhaps those of a deer, a sizable deer. It has crossed the driveway more than once. He sees a place where it stood for a while, pawing the ground. No tire tracks mar the mud because they were erased by the rain that had been falling when he'd come home. Evidently, the deer spore date from after the storm. He crouches beside the tracks and puts his fingers to the cold mud. He can feel the hardness and smoothness of the hooves that stamped the marks. A variety of deer thrive in the nearby foothills and mountains. They rarely venture onto Mr. Vess's property, however, because they are frightened of the Dobermans. This is the most peculiar thing about the deer tracks, that among them are no paw prints from the dogs. The Dobermans have been trained to focus on human intruders and as much as possible to ignore wildlife. Otherwise, they might be distracted at a moment crucial to their master's safety. They will never attack rabbits or squirrels or possums or deer, unless severe hunger eventually drives them to it. They won't even give playful chase. Nevertheless, the dogs will take notice of other animals that cross their path. They indulge their curiosity within the limits of their training. They would have approached this deer and circled ever closer as it stood here, either paralyzing it with fright or spooking it off. And after it had gone, they would have padded back and forth across the driveway, sniffing its spoor. But not one paw print is visible among the hoof impressions.